Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by David Downey, who is a professor of English at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. He's the author of 4 award-winning books on C.S. Lewis. With David Downey, we're going inside the pages of Looking for the King, an Inklings novel, published by Ignatius Press. Looking for the King, an Inklings novel, brings to life the beloved writers C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, and Charles Williams in the context of an exciting and fast-paced adventure story. The novel opens in 1940. An American, Tom Accord, a 23-year-old aspiring doctoral candidate, is in England researching the historical evidence for the legendary King Arthur. There he meets perky and intuitive Laura Hartman, a fellow American staying with her aunt in Oxford. And the two of them team up for an even more ambitious and dangerous quest. Aided by the Inklings, that illustrious circle of scholars and writers made famous by its 2 most prolific members, C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, Tom and Laura begin to suspect that the fabled Spear of Destiny, the lance that pierced the side of Christ on the cross, is hidden somewhere in England. Weaving his fast-paced narrative with actual quotes from the works of the Inklings, author David Downing offers a vivid portrait of Oxford and draws a welcome glimpse into the personalities and ideas of Lewis, Tolkien, and Williams, while never losing sight of his action-packed adventure story and its 2 very appealing main characters. Looking for the King has piqued the interest of Inkling lovers everywhere and has already earned advanced praise. Joseph Pierce, author of Tolkien, Man and Myth, says, quote, "This superbly gripping novel about dreams coming true is itself a dream come true. Lewis and Tolkien come alive as real-life characters, playing their parts to realistic perfection as the protagonists follow their Arthurian quest pursued by deadly enemies. For lovers of Arthurian romances and for admirers of Tolkien and Lewis, this is indeed a dream come true." We now begin our discussion on Inside the Pages of Looking for the King, an Inklings novel, with David Downing. Welcome, David.
And I'm glad to be with you today.
David, Looking for the King is subtitled as an Inklings novel. Let's talk about the Inklings first. Who are they, and how did you get to know them?
Okay. The Inklings were an informal literary circle that met from the early 30s until the late 1940s. The 2 most prominent members were C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. And they tended to meet twice a week, usually on Tuesday mornings at a local pub, the Eagle and Child, which they called the Bird and Baby, and then on Thursday evenings in Lewis's rooms. The Thursday evening meetings were more formal. They would tend to read manuscripts to each other and critique each other's work. And so some of Lewis's science fiction was read on Thursday evenings, and a great portion of The Lord of the Rings was read on Thursday evenings. I think I first got to know them through reading C.S. Lewis and then finding out that he was a good friend with Tolkien. They seemed to be the nucleus of the group.
What a fascinating group that must have been. I mean, can you imagine being a fly on that wall?
Well, that's part of the reason I wrote the novel is I speak a lot on Lewis and Tolkien. And some people, they know the Narnia films and the books, and they know The Lord of the Rings. And when they hear that these 2 men were best friends, they're just thunderstruck. And they say, were they very similar? And actually, they weren't that similar in person. And they say, wouldn't you love to be a fly on the wall? Or wouldn't you love to go in a time machine and go back to an Inklings meeting? And I'd done so much research on the 2 of them, I thought I could imaginatively provide that service for many of the people that I hear about that request.
Well, not only did you give us a glimpse of possible conversations that they had, and even in some cases, some of the things they actually did say, but you give us a glimpse into their minds, and well, maybe even more effectively into their hearts, because you've fashioned not a biography, not a nonfiction work, but a beautiful fiction work, again, entitled Looking for the King. And why don't you give everyone a sense of the premise of the book?
Okay. It's the year is 1940, which is when England is already at war with Germany. The United States had not entered the war yet. That wouldn't come until Pearl Harbor in December 1941. But there are 2 Americans in England, Tom McCord is doing research on King Arthur. He would like to prove there's a historical King Arthur. And he meets Laura Hartman, who's a young American staying with her aunt in Oxford. And she's having troubling dreams, and she thinks the answer to her dreams lies somewhere in England. So she's trying to find an interpretation of a number of visionary dreams she has. And when two of them meet, they discover that they have a lot of interest in common, and they think if they team up, they might be able to be a mutual benefit. Once they go to Oxford, they meet Lewis and Tolkien and then Charles Williams, and piece by piece, the puzzle begins to fall together until they realize what it is they're actually looking for.
Charles Williams, talk to us about him.
Well, Charles Williams was probably the third most prominent member of the Inklings. There were really 12 or 15 that met regularly. It depended upon who was in town and who was out of town. He was an editor for Oxford University Press, and he was an autodidact. He was a little unlike the other Inklings in that he grew up more working class around London. They thought he had a bit of a Cockney accent, but he was a voracious reader and the proverbial walking encyclopedia. And he was up there in Oxford during the war years. When they started bombing London, Oxford University Press relocated from London to Oxford. So he was there from 1939 until his death in 1945. So here you have three of the greatest Christian minds of the 20th century all meeting once or twice a week to talk about ideas and exchange manuscripts. So it must have been an incredibly rich time for them.
Oh, it has become richer for us with the work that you're doing now, because I think, David, for many people, they desire to have good fiction which engages the virtues in the mind and even that Christian background. But in recent times, there have been those works, like, oh, dare I say it, the Da Vinci Code and other things that have tried to tap into that Christian heritage, or at least that virtuous heritage, and have twisted it and have given the church as a whole really negative connotations. And you don't do that in your work.
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, it's not really an antidote to the Da Vinci Code. It would take a much longer novel.
Mm-hmm.
George Orwell said, if you tell the big lie, then you can get away with it more than if you tell a lot of little lies. And I think Dan Brown, I think in some ways he's counting on people's lack of knowledge about the Bible and about church history. At last count, there were more than 100 just factual errors, not to mention interpretive errors. I was thinking for my next project, I might write a novel about a fellow named Dan Braun, who belongs to a secret satanic society, and they decided to discredit the church and Christian history through this, through a work of fiction. And if someone accused me of libeling anyone living, I would say, oh, it's only a novel. Don't take it so seriously. It's just entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
How would that be for my next project?
Oh, well, I hope you do that the same time you do more Inklings.
Actually, I am thinking of a sequel for this story. I left some unraveled threads at the end about whether or not Tom might come back to England, and Laura wants to come back and perhaps get a master's degree in Oxford. So I tried to leave some open-ended sections at the end of the novel for the possibility of a sequel.
Well, it is very gripping. I mean, that's the joy in this, is that there are many who will, and may I say God love them, that will attempt to do quote-unquote Christian fiction, but it doesn't come off real well because it has to first be good fiction, period. And I think that's what you do. It's a wonderful diving into that, seeking to explore, being intrepid, the mystery, and involving characters that we can even relate to. And it was beautiful in incorporating these wonderful writers as part of the story.
Yeah, that was a great deal of fun for me because I wanted to tell an adventure story and I wanted to have a bit of a love story going on in the background. But then I also wanted to give readers a sense of what it would really be like to meet Tolkien and Lewis and Charles Williams. So I had a lot of different strands I was interweaving, so it was a very challenging project for me and a very stimulating project.
I alluded to earlier that you do take gleanings from their actual writings. Was that difficult to do that and incorporate it into the fiction?
Well, that's part of the reason I wrote the novel. I was reading the letters of C.S. Lewis the same summer. The Collected Letters, Volume 2, came out the same summer that my wife and I were traveling in England, and we were going through Somerset and Cornwall visiting King Arthur sites. And we kept hearing about Joseph of Arimathea and the Spear of Destiny, which was the spear that thrust the side of Christ, and the Holy Grail. So on the one hand, I had all these interests developing in my mind just from visiting the southwestern corner of England, but I was also reading the letters. And both Tolkien and Lewis, in their letters, would have a one-liner. Someone said they were moving to California for the climate, and Lewis says, "Oh, I would never move somewhere for the climate unless I were a vegetable." Mm-hmm. And I thought, what a great quip. I wish I could put that into a line of dialogue. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with Tolkien. He says things like, "Oh, the Greeks have their Iliad and the Odyssey, and the Finns have their Kalevala, their great national epic. It's too bad someone can't write an epic story which would capture the spirit of Englishness." And he was longing for that, not realizing that he himself would put together a fantasy epic that many people would consider to be a great embodiment of the English spirit. So reading their letters, I was thinking, I would love to get this into conversation and dialogue, and that's why I started thinking I should have them be characters in my adventure novel.
Well, it really is a tremendous adventure novel. It's such a joy to be able to have one of those in your hands and to be able to dive into the characters. I hope you do more, especially with these particular characters, all of them. That's what makes great sequels, is that we're so familiar with the characters and we want to continue on.
Right.
When writing this, what was it like getting into the minds, of a Lewis and a Tolkien, especially in that the fashioning of fiction? I mean, it's one thing to write about their lives and to write about the works, but then to get into the mechanics of the thinking as they do.
That was a challenge. Actually, I'd written 4 earlier books about Lewis, which involved Tolkien, so I knew about both of them quite a bit. Actually, I had focused on them as thinkers and writers, so I was more familiar with their ideas than I was with their daily life during the 1940s. For the research for this novel, I actually had to go back and say, now, what would Lewis wear on a typical day, or what would he order for lunch in a pub?
Mm-hmm.
Or I found out that Tolkien enjoyed wearing a flamboyant vest. He would dress very plainly in a tweed jacket and flannel pants, but then he would have on a scarlet vest or a green vest. So in some ways, the new part for me was going back and looking at them as human beings,
mm-hmm.
their conversational habits, what they enjoyed for lunch, their family relations. Tolkien was a devout family man. So in some ways, for me, rediscovering Lewis and Tolkien, it more had to do with what they were like as individuals on any given day than the broad reach of their ideas. I already knew about most of their literary ideas and their theological ideas.
What's always fascinating about reading Tolkien and Lewis is trying to remember, as you're reading their fantasy, as you're reading their fiction, whether it's The Lord of the Rings or The Chronicles of Narnia, is that they were living during one of the most devastating centuries of all mankind. They were living at a time when there was tremendous evil and tumultuously horrific wars that were occurring on the face of the earth. In their books, they do have that element of good battling that unbelievably oppressive evil. In your work, today, do you see that type of drama being played out in our present time so that writers that can grab that same milieu?
Well, in some ways, I think we have more of the darkness in present-day writing than we do in Lewis and Tolkien. In some ways, they were able to convey the power of goodness or good characters in a way that I don't see in a lot of contemporary fiction. In some ways, post-World War II and Vietnam and Freudian analysis, which emphasizes everyone's neuroses and the repressed desires. When I read a lot of contemporary fiction, I'm struck at people's ability to create negative characters
mm-hmm.
who are neurotic or narcissistic or depraved, but I don't find too many admirable characters who are self-sacrificing and courageous and looking out for others. And I think Lewis and Tolkien are actually unusual in that they could convey the dark side. You have these satanic figures, and you have these very dark individuals, but they also could portray courage and self-sacrifice and camaraderie. And I'm sure that had to do with their Christian worldview. So I find more of a balance in their fiction than I do in a lot. People are often mentioning to me contemporary names, and when I try to pick up and read the person, it's just so dark, and there's just so much moral confusion and spiritual confusion that I'm put off by the worldview behind the fiction. So I feel like I go back to Lewis and Tolkien for a kind of spiritual cleansing after reading contemporary literature.
I think that's why Looking for the King is such a joy to read. I just had so much fun with it. And, well, let's talk a little bit about the character dynamics of Tom. How did you fashion him? Where did you, what elements did you pull from other people to make Tom the man of virtue that he is?
Well, I had to figure out who could be visiting England in 1940 when Lewis, Tolkien, and Williams were all together in Oxford. And so I was thinking, why would an American be there? So I came up with the idea of research. This is somewhat unconscious, but he's something of a version of my younger self. He went to UCLA and I went to UCLA. I think if I'd been born in an earlier generation, he's somewhat academically adept, but he's not very socially smooth. Mm-hmm. And he feels the need to prove himself. And he has these tremendous ambitions. If only he could discover King Arthur, if only he could write this important book or discover the spear, he could become somebody. And I think that reflects not only me, but a lot of young people. I'm a college professor, and I have a lot of students who still want to write the great American novel or the great American screenplay. And sometimes they say, well, I'm not going to forget you, Dr. Downing. When I become big, I'm going to put you in a footnote or I'm going to acknowledge you on my album cover. And there's something about the curious ambition of youth, but also the insecurities of youth all mixed in there together. So in Tom, I was trying to capture that the youth who is intellectually adept but not very socially smooth, and someone in some ways who had these overweening ambitions, but in other ways was unusually insecure.
Talk to us about Laura, the dreamer.
Laura is actually somewhat of a tribute to both Tolkien and Lewis. Lewis has Jane Studdick, who has these strange dreams and that hideous strength, and she doesn't quite know herself. In the novel, she has to evolve and figure out what her spiritual worldview is and what she thinks about Christianity. There's also a character in a Williams novel, Descent into Hell, Paula Anstruther, who's having these strange visions which she has to understand. She's seeing, as a matter of fact, she gets mentioned in the novel. So in some ways, Laura was my homage to Williams and Lewis because they both had young women with visionary dreams that needed to be interpreted. I meant for her to be much more spiritually grounded than Tom. She already knows who she is and knows what she believes. And so she, even the Lewis and Tolkien and Williams are all great mentors for Tom. But I wanted him to have someone his own age who could model just more of a well-grounded faith and spiritual worldview.
Well, she really is the heart center.
Yes, I think that's true. In some ways, you might say, in terms of their quest, that Tom is sort of the head of their quest and she's the heart of their quest. I would agree with that.
Yeah, I think the compatibility on that is it makes for a nice balance, and you watch both of them grow in the process. And I think that's good with any relationship. I mean, that's what I think the character, as they develop throughout the novel, I think that's what makes them interesting characters that you're rooting for, and you do like them. You wish you knew them.
Yes, I wanted to have them have kind of a light banter between the two of them. I never stated it explicitly, but she is devout about her faith, and she can tell that Tom is very confused about his faith and his worldview and his spiritual values. And she's kind of following the old biblical advice about not being mismated with unbelievers. So you can tell there's the attraction there or the romantic tension, but she's kind of keeping him at arm's length because she wants to see where he's headed spiritually. That's why there's a little bit more romance at the end of the novel. I think she can tell that he's pointed in the right direction in terms of his own growth of his faith.
Well, we've talked about the protagonists. Let's talk about the antagonists, the villains that always help make a great adventure work. How did you fashion them?
Well, I decided to, obviously, in these kind of thrillers or adventure novels, I don't quite think of it as a thriller because there are quite a few long conversations. Someone said, do you think of this as a cloak and dagger novel? And I said, no, I think it more of a cloak and lager novel because there is some mystery, but there's also quite a bit of sitting around in pubs trying to figure out literature and legend and the meaning of life and the nature of faith. There are some long, leisurely passages where people talk about ideas and what their life means. But I wanted the negative characters to be mysterious. This is often true of this kind of a story. Why are they being shadowed? What are people looking for? Tom and Laura don't even know why these sinister characters are after them until halfway through the novel. There's actually a legend, which I'm having trouble pinning down, that Hitler actually was worried about having the wrong spear of destiny. There's this long legend that the spear that thrust the side of Christ on the cross was saved by the Roman soldier, who's usually called Longinus, mm-hmm. and it was passed from generation to generation. And Constantine claimed he had it, and Charlemagne claimed that he had it. And there's actually it's difficult to pin down in the biographies, but there's a sense that Hitler was very interested in the occult, and he thought if he could get some of these talismans on his side, that would give him that much more spiritual energy to win his battles. He did have a spear called the Holy Lance, which he confiscated from a museum in Vienna, but it looks more medieval than Roman. As a matter of fact, a recent meddler just looked at it and said the metal used in the spearhead actually is medieval, not Roman. Mm. And so there's some speculation that he was insecure about having the spear of invincibility, and he was looking for it. And the best place to look for it would be in England. There's a number of candidates for where it may be hidden. So I wanted my antagonist to be either fortune hunters or actual agents of the other side who were trying to find one more weapon to use in World War II.
Mm. To go back to the Inkling side, we spoke of three, and you have brought forward Williams, who a lot of people, Charles Williams, who may not be familiar with. Of the other Inklings, are there those who have kind of captured your imagination or have touched your heart in some way?
Well, I've always been fascinated by Hugo Dyson. He was another professor. He was down at Reading, south of Oxford. And he loved to make Shakespearean puns, and he loved to take famous Shakespearean quotes and misquote them. But there are only a few on record, so I thought it would be fun to try to bring some of his ebullient sense of humor and wit into some of the Inklings meetings. So he was one of the ones that fascinates me the most. He was instrumental, along with Tolkien, in Lewis becoming a Christian. Lewis had been... He'd been raised in a nominal Christian environment in Northern Ireland, and then after his mother died, he drifted away from that, and he considered himself an atheist for most of his teens and his 20s. But when he met Hugo Dyson and Tolkien in Oxford in the late 20s, he was very attracted to them. He'd been thinking they were thinking people who were not believers and believing people who were not thinkers. And here he ran into Tolkien and Dyson and could tell that they were both quite serious about their faith, but they were serious scholars. And they spent all one night talking about the dying god myth, the idea that every culture has some legend of a god who dies and is reborn for the sake of the people. And earlier anthropologists had argued that proves that there was nothing special about the Gospels. It was just one more dying god myth. But Tolkien and Dyson said, well, don't you see, there's a universal longing for redemption. People realize they can't save themselves through their own efforts. But in the Gospels, the myth becomes history. It actually happened. And so they reframed that issue for Lewis and made him realize that what he saw as an argument against Christianity could actually be used as an argument for Christianity. And that was really the beginning of his conversion process, when he realized that the dying God myth is actually just a universal longing for redemption that was fulfilled finally in the incarnation.
Mm. Yeah, and again, it's such a joy to go back and read Lewis and to read Tolkien and to see that power of the symbol, but that is so much more than just something that's surface, but always has the deeper meaning. And I think you helped to continue on that wonderful depth in what fiction can bring to us as it explores deeper into our hearts with looking for the king. And we did talk, David, about the darker side of contemporary literature, today's fiction. Is there a brighter side besides your work, of course, but are there writers today? Do we have the Inklings today? Do we have those who are attempting to take us to a higher level?
Well, you mentioned earlier Christian fiction, and there's a lot of upbeat fiction with a happy ending, but it often doesn't have the literary quality you're looking for. And then you have the authors with the great literary qualities who don't have a Christian worldview. I think of Marilynne Robinson as someone who's a very promising contemporary writer whose Christian faith shines through her beautiful prose. She's obviously not a fantasy writer, but she has a great depth of insight about human nature and also a poetic prose style. I also like a novel called Peace Like a River by Leif Inger, which is kind of a Garrison Keillor take on spirituality. You're in the Midwest in a family in the 50s with these strange supernatural events keep happening, which suggests that there are spiritual realities behind ordinary life. So those are some encouraging beacons I see out there amidst a lot of fiction, which seems rather forgettable to me.
Well, I'd encourage everyone out there to pick up a copy of Looking for the King, an Inklings novel, and to pass that on. And I highly encourage you, for what it's worth, to continue on, which could become quite a classic series.
Well, I'm enjoying it, and I do have some good ideas. Excuse me. You mentioned things getting darker, and as the war grew even more grim for the English, it's interesting that Tolkien, Lewis, and Williams, all three, wrote some of their darkest works later in the 40s. This novel set in 1940. Williams wrote a book on witchcraft. Tolkien's character of Sauron was coming to the surface, and Lewis wrote the Screwtape Letters. And so I think the second novel will actually deal even more explicitly with the dark side and possible dark forces, almost spiritual warfare behind the literal warfare of World War II. So if anything, it probably will have a tone of trying to deal with the problem of evil, not just in human behavior, but a sense that there are spiritual forces in the high places that seem to be doing battle against humanity.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it.
And I will have the same characters. I feel like Tom and Laura have just begun to get to know each other, so I think they probably need to be reunited and work on their relationship a little bit more.
I think it'd be fantastic. David Downing, I just thank you so much for taking on the task of bringing forth good fiction for all of us to read.
Well, thank you.
We've been going inside the pages of David Downing's book, Looking for the King, an Inklings novel. For more information on how you can obtain this book, go to www.lookingfortheking.com, a special website for the book set up by Ignatius Press, or you can visit any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and download this discussion along with many others, go to www.insidethepages.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.